You know, by the way your spouse touches you, what their goal is. Are they just trying to get you to want to have sex? Or are they saying, I'm so glad you're here. I like you. You mean something to me. So much meaning is communicated through the body and especially through sex. And that's why a lot of couples don't like having sex, is because the meaning that's being communicated is anti-erotic. It's pressuring, demanding, it's belittling. And so the physicality is not the problem. In fact, it's the deep benefit of sex. Because when you really cherish another soul through sex, sex is a powerfully beautiful meaning and very anchoring to a marriage.
Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Jennifer, a collection of interviews on the topics of relationships, sexuality, spirituality, and more, all featuring Dr. Finlayson Fife.
Hey everyone, we just returned from a couples tour in Portugal that was absolutely amazing. There were just 10 couples, and the smallness of the group made it particularly wonderful because there was more time for conversation and interaction and for the couples to get to know each other and really support one another in the growth that they did over those 10 amazing days. The great news is we have another trip this year going from Zurich, Switzerland to Austria, and we would love to have you join us. We still have room for two more couples, and it promises to be a small group. And the cutoff date for registering is May 2nd. So if you've been thinking about doing one of these couples tours, I highly recommend it, and I highly recommend Switzerland and Austria. So I hope to see you there. Again, the cutoff date for registration is May 2nd. Click on the link in the show notes for more information. Thanks, everyone.
I've been looking forward to this major milestone of episode number 300 for a long time, and I wanted to make this episode really special and maybe a little different from my other episodes. So I've been pondering for a while how to do that. I've also been pondering what's the difference between just having sex and making love. I thought I'd make this a special research project. So I reached out to a few mentors and professionals that I admire and look up to, and I asked them, what's the difference between having sex and making love? The responses have been really inspiring and life-changing for me, and you get to join me on this journey and hear what they've shared with me. First is Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife. She's a highly sought-after voice in the space of healthy sexuality in marriage. Her latest book, That We Might Have Joy, is an excellent read for anyone seeking to reconcile spirituality and sexuality. The second guest is Dr. Shalom Levitt. She's a sexuality researcher at Brigham Young University, a mother of 8 children, and a friend of mine. And the third is Adam and Carissa King. They're a marriage therapist duo, and you'll find them online at Dear Young Married Couple. Now let's listen to Dr. Jennifer Finlayson Fife and my conversation with her about this topic. So Jennifer, what are your thoughts when you hear the question, what's the difference between having sex and making love?
Well, I don't know that I want to, like, I don't want to get rigid about the wording because I think that I think I know what you're pointing at, but I would never be like, oh, it's one or the other per se, because there's a rawness and a physicality to sex that I think is legitimate. Sometimes we try to sanitize it through the language of making love.
Yeah.
But I think maybe what you're pointing at is, you know, soulful sex versus sex that lacks some aliveness and a sense of connection. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of couples feel like maybe they have sex, but they don't have this sense of attraction and desire and aliveness that they felt often in the beginning of the relationship and that they wish sex were giving them. And so a lot of the people that come to me sometimes come in the frame of like, we aren't having much sex, or I wish we were having more sex. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the bigger thing that's lacking is that sense of attraction, desire, passion, mm-hmm. of you're my person, that people want to feel.
Does it mean something's gone wrong if early in the relationship you tend to have a lot of that aliveness, but now fast forward 10, 20 years, it's not quite there anymore?
I wouldn't say anything's gone wrong. In fact, I might say it's pretty normal from a statistical point of view.
that people kind of lose that thread. They lose the aliveness, much because of what we do in marriage and in life. We kill the joy in it through our pursuit of safety and reassurance and certainty. So a lot of what inspires the erotic in the beginning is easy to want to try to control or contain. And so we naturally kill that energy. So I wouldn't say anything's gone wrong, but I would say that even though it's understandable, it does kill a lot of the joy that we anticipate we're going to experience in marriage.
Can you give me a specific example? Like, what's one thing that we tend to kill that would have otherwise given a lot of interest in life?
Well, I mean, one thing that just comes to mind right away is that we all, living in the 20th century, enjoy amazing wealth compared to a couple hundred years ago. Even kings didn't have as much as the common person has today. Mm-hmm. And yet, we're pretty miserable. And so that is, humans have the ability to habituate and become entitled around good things in their lives, including their spouse. So when you fall in love, you tend to be like, this person's so amazing. I can't believe I met them. It's so magical and wonderful. And I'm so grateful they're here. And you have all that energy that drives passion.
Like full of wonder.
The wonder in it, the amazement of who you are. And I see you as this person that's different from me. But then we quickly go into the entitled frame of like, you know, yeah, well, you're supposed to do that. You're my husband. Or yeah, you're supposed to do that. You're my wife. Or what have you done for me lately? Our desire to have what we want, to not actually make room for a person that's different than us, often kicks in. Mm-hmm. And we move into an energy of control and predictability that blocks our awareness of the wonder and the awe of the other person. Mm-hmm. And so it's understandable that we want what we want. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is to say, when you're living a single life, it's easy to go to the grocery store when you want, go to bed when you want, but you're lonely. Mm-hmm. Then you fall in love and your brain is flooded with dopamine. And so you're like, oh my gosh, it's going to be amazing because we like all the same things and we can talk so easily. But then when you actually move in together and start building a life, you know, you're like, well, we're going to bed at the wrong time, or, you know, why you go to the grocery store too often or whatever, you know, you start coming up with these things. I want you to do the things that the way I want you to do them. And of course they are often, our partner's putting pressure in another way. And so then we start feeling like I'm not going to get what I want with you. So I need to pressure you or feel frustrated with you or resent you or hide who I am from you. And so those inclinations are very, very normal human behaviors. But the more we do those things, the more we kill the aliveness of the marriage, because what makes us feel alive in marriage is this idea that I can be myself and I can also be with you and known by you. Mm-hmm. I don't have to pretend or manage or shut down parts of myself to make this work. But in order to create that reality, you know, again, when you're falling in love, you think you have it because you don't know each other very well yet. And dopamine is helping tremendously. But when you start to really get to know each other and you're building a life together, well, then to create that kind of reality, you have to grow into somebody that can be compatible, that's capable of it, somebody that can make room for another without betraying what is true and honest in you. And that's developmental work. I think we love the idea that if you find the right person, it's easy and you know, you don't have any trouble. Uh-huh. But I just don't think that's true. Marriage is something you create through your growth and through your courage and through your honesty and through your willingness to give.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. I love that developmental model. It's like nothing's gone wrong. It just means you haven't, this is just pushing on the points in you that are inviting you to grow and develop to your next level, whatever that might be, right? We accept that invitation. That's the pathway that could lead to more passion, more aliveness.
Right, exactly. Nothing prepares you for being a parent as much as being a parent or prepares you for marriage as much as getting married, because then you're in the thick of it and you have to figure out, what do I need to grow to be capable of this? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And reading all of the parenting books or marriage books before being a parent or a marriage might help you a little bit, but no, it's actually in the...
Right.
It's like bicycle, right? If I give you a book on how to ride a bike and you've never ridden a bike before.
Yeah.
Very right. different experience than actually getting on the bike.
Yeah, for sure.
What about this pattern then in marriages where sex becomes something where it feels like you're giving sex a job, that you use it to like prove something about who you are, like it's tied to your worth? How does that make it less lovemaking, so to speak, less of this aliveness and more transaction?
Yeah. Yeah. I write about this in my book a lot, which is that when we're earlier in our development, and most of us get married earlier in our development, we're very concerned with the self. You know, it's like, yes, I love you, but kind of like, I love you because of how you make me feel about me. Mm-hmm. I love what I imagine marrying you is going to offer to my life. And it's not like we're sitting around being greedy and so on, but we're often have that motivation happening more than we realize. Mm-hmm. And then when you actually marry the person, the thing you usually that you promised at the altar is, I'm going to love this person even when they're driving me crazy. So usually what we focus on is, you're supposed to love me, not that I'm going to love you. And so that is to say that in sex, which is very central to our sense of self, as I write about, and it therefore feels very exposing, mm-hmm. sex does. Like if the person that you share a bed with doesn't like you, doesn't want to be close to you, doesn't like having sex with you, that hurts a lot. Right? And or am I prepared to really let a person into my body, let them really, really know me in this way? I might want to be married to you, but I don't know if I want to be that connected. So that is to say that these questions around our sense of self and how much we want to let somebody in are very alive in marriage. Mm-hmm. And when we're younger in our development, the ego, our self-protection, our desire to get reinforcement is driving us a lot. And so that can be then expressed in the form of being low desire for sex or low desire for intimacy or letting somebody in, or it can be high desire, like I want you to tell me I'm enough. I want you to want me. So that tends to mean that sex ends up taking on a lot of demand of what it's going to prove about us or what it's going to manage in the relationship. And the more sex gets weighed down with the needs of the ego, mm-hmm. the more that it tends to kill its power, its mm-hmm. erotic energy. The more free we feel to be ourselves, the freer we feel to desire without feeling that we're going to be judged or punished or whatever, then the better sex tends to be, the more alive it feels. And so I have a course called Sex Worth Wanting. And, you know, my goal with couples is not just about helping them have more sex. It's helping them create the energy that they're really longing for and to understand what in their marriage is interfering with creating it, right? How are they behaving around the issues of sex or even around how open-hearted and honest the marriage is that's killing the passion that brought them together in the first place?
I like that. I've shared this on my podcast in the past, but years ago in my own marriage, I would keep track in true nerd fashion, how often we're having sex, and I would track orgasms and things like frequently and whatever. Oh, I remember looking at the chart once. It's like, wow, for every 10 times we're together, my wife has an orgasm. I must be a really poor lover. I made that reflect on me. Mm. She's not having, like, we're not even.
It's about me.
Yeah. It's mm-hmm. about me. And then knowing that, our sexual encounters were, I was very hyper-focused on her and having a certain outcome. If the littlest mm-hmm. thing threw us off, I would be put out because mm-hmm. it meant I was a poor lover. Then things got worse and worse and worse. And we didn't want to engage sexually at all because now there's all this pressure that needs to be a certain way.
Right.
And
pressure, it's going to measure you badly and also measure her badly, basically.
Yeah, right. And my poor wife, she's like, if I don't get an orgasm, he's going to feel lousy. And I don't want him to feel that way. And under that pressure, your body's going to respond.
Yeah.
Right? So, so counterproductive. And
And there's nothing free about it at all.
No.
Right? It's all about measurement and success or failure. And he's going to feel bad about himself, but he's also going to feel bad about me because I'm not producing what will make him feel good. And yes, whenever sex is given that kind of a job, it kills the freedom in it. And, you know, it's paradoxical, I think, because pleasure and desire thrive in freedom.
Yes.
And marriage is not anything about freedom, right? You know, like we're like, you know, we're kind of containing and so on. And so there is a paradox inherent to it. But it's also about how we relate to marriage. Do we see it as a chosen container, or do we relate to it as a prison? And if it's like, well, I have to do this because this is my husband's, you know, this is what he needs, or
he's not going to be happy, whatever. Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, all that garbage. And it just can make it so psychologically we're in a mind. It's not that our body's broken, although a lot of people will think that's the problem. It's in fact, we're in a mind that's killing Eros without realizing it.
You've told me before how just understanding our self-worth or connecting to our sense of value within ourselves is great erotic fuel. It helps us break out of these patterns that we've talked about. Can you talk on that a little bit more?
I guess what I would say is the more we're in an anxious mind, and I mean especially in a long-term marriage, because if you're just having an affair or basically it's a different calculus, because there's a different kind of validation happening early on in a relationship. But with somebody that really knows you, the more that you are measuring yourself through them, the less free you feel in the marriage, the less free you feel to be yourself. The pressure then is to be more able to self-reference. And a lot of people think that means being selfish, but that is that you can anchor more into your own mind, into your own thoughts, your own beliefs, your own feelings, and you can settle yourself. Mm-hmm. The most powerful person in a room is the calmest person. The person that's most able to be anchored into themselves. They don't have to prove themselves. They're not trying to get attention. They're not reactive. They're settled, right? And so in a marriage, the more that you're in reaction to each other, the more you feel controlled by each other, because in a sense, you are being controlled by the other person. This is also true in sex, because the more we can be at peace in our own skin, the freer we are to desire another person and to be known by them. And so a lot of time when we're coming in with that, I'm going to measure myself around this encounter, we're in an anxious body and mind. And the more that we're settled down together and can bring something of ourselves into the encounter, the more alive and meaningful that it is, right? You can't make love out of this anxious pursuit of approval. Mm-hmm. It has to come out of some desire and gratitude for the presence of the other, some ability to love and value who they are. And that has to come from our center. And that's what we all long for in good sex, is to feel known and loved and accepted as we are, right? That I don't have to prove anything. I can be here with you and be valued by you. That's what we most want. And that takes character development, both to be able to receive that kind of care and to be able to give that kind of care.
I like that. That's good. Really comes down to that learning how to love and love well.
Yeah, exactly.
If I jump back to the very, very beginning of our conversation, you said there is a physicality side of sex that we tend to sanitize too much. Can we roll on that for a second? Like, let's talk about why it's okay to see the carnal side or the physical side of very good sex.
Yeah. So in chapter 9 of my book, I write about the value of the body, even for spiritual meaning, for psychological communion, because I think often in a Christian tradition, we tend to see the body as evil, the thing that pulls the spirit down. And I think a much better understanding is the Socrates idea that the body is an instrument of perception. That the way we knew we were loved when we were a baby was entirely through the language of the body. That's how you knew you were safe, that you were accepted, that you were cherished, that you gave your parent delight in just being alive. It was all through the physical. There was no, you know, verbal in the beginning. The body has this ability to express meaning in a way that our linear and logical minds are always secondary to. And so you know by the way your spouse touches you what their goal is. Are they just trying to get you to want to have sex, or are they saying, I'm so glad you're here. I like you. You mean something to me. And so much meaning is communicated through the body, and especially through sex. And that's why a lot of couples don't like having sex, is because the meaning that's being communicated is anti-erotic. It's pressuring, it's demanding, it's belittling. And so the physicality is not the problem. In fact, it's the deep benefit of sex. Because when you really cherish another soul through sex, sex is a powerfully beautiful meaning and very anchoring to a marriage. Very, very good for a marriage. And I think we're afraid, well, it must be always, I love you, I let you know, it has to be cleaned up. And I think sometimes just the freedom to express our eroticism, to be free, to be fully sexual beings, and to have the safety of being able to accept this part of our humanity, to accept it in the other, to have a safe space for this part of being human. I mean, that's sacred in my mind. And so I think sometimes we try to sanitize out of our fear, but not the people that really know how truly sacred it can be to be fully free with another person.
I think some people fear like they're going to be doing something wrong if they let go, because on the other side of that feels like, I can't think of a great word, animalistic, a little more raw. And if maybe that's wrong, because they don't express that in other areas publicly in their lives.
Yeah.
And so therefore, they always, like, in the act of sex, they get close to that point, but they hold back. They're timid and don't give in.
And I think, you know, I think that there is a sense in it, because a lot of our religious traditions and religious education has to do with inhibiting our impulses. Just getting socialized is learning to inhibit impulses. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean a kind of indulgent loss, losing track of your spouse. You know, I don't mean just losing control. So either.
Yes.
So it's not a kind of indulgent escape from life.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a paradox in it, because the more we learn how to have breaks, the freer we are. Sometimes the pursuit of breaks is to crush, you know, is to crush our sexuality and our eroticism, and that's very counterproductive. So we need to learn to have breaks, but then we're able to drive that car where we want to and drive fast in it even if we want, because we trust our ability to not do something destructive. So in the book, I write about learning how to ski. Like, the first thing you're learning is how to, you know, stop, okay? Because you don't want to get on that slope and just crash into a tree.
I was just talking about my kids skiing and teaching them how to ski. And that's, once they know they can stop, then they feel like they can go fast.
Then they start having some freedom with it and freedom to experience the pleasure and the glee even of going down that mountain, because you're not just out of control. Mm-hmm. You're able to make choices, but then you're able to experience pleasure in a much deeper, richer way, because it's not an indulgent, I'm just taking care of myself here. It's that I can express my full sexuality because I trust myself and I trust you, and I can bring it to you fully, but I can even love you through it, right? Love and be loved through it. And so sometimes we make it that, any suppression is shame, or any kind of real pleasure is indulgent. And I think both of those ideas are wrong.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, we ask that you please rate, review, and share the podcast so that more people can find and benefit from Dr. Jennifer's work.